I think we're gonna make a start. So it's week two of the Kabbalah meditation course, exploring the layers and the complexity of human personality. As I said last week, this is a very intricate and complex series, really, and we should hopefully in the future we'll do it in much more greater detail. So these are just highlights. So I just want to sort of begin with a bit of a review from last week. So last week we talked about the name of the person being Adam, coming from the two words Adama and Adamele Elyon. Adama means earth. The first man was created by God taking the clay and creating the human being. That's the body. On the other hand, the soul is Adamele Elyon, compared similar to the above. In other words, we have created in the image of God. So it's two opposites, the two words. Adama is really earthliness, mundane, material. Adamel Elyon is really godly consciousness, divine infusion, and so on. And in fact, we didn't say this last week, but these two words of Adam, these two meanings of Adam, which are really opposites, really express the mission of the human being. Because the mission of the human being is really to bring together, to marry the two worlds, to marry the body and the soul, that they should live in harmony, to marry the physical and the spiritual, the mundane and the holy. So those two words come together in one word, and therefore the person is called Adam. Both meanings, Adama, earthliness, mundane, and Adama Le'elyon, which is more spiritual. Which of course also explains why the person is called B'Tselem Elokim. We are created in the image of God. What does it mean, the image of God? So we explained last week that, in great detail, we explain that God expresses himself in what we call, the Kabbalah calls, 10 Sfirot, which are the 10 powers, the 10 tools of creation, God's manifestation of him choosing to be defined and expressed and manifested in 10 ways. Three of them being intellectual, where God is processing, so to speak, within himself, and seven emotions, where he connects to us and connects to the world, hence the creation of the world in 7 days. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, so Daat and Keter are a little bit interchangeable. In some Kabbalistic sources you will find Keter on top, actually. Keter, Chochma, Bina. Keter is really the crown. In other words, that's the will, the desire, the intrinsic essence of the human, like you talk about the human being, or the intrinsic essence of God driving the 10. Now, the reason that Chochma, Keter and Daat are interchangeable is a long discussion, but essentially, as I said last week on your handout, you have it that the Sfirot come in triangles. And we say that anything that's in the middle is sourced and goes all the way up to Keter. That's why sometimes Keter and Daat are interchangeable. Perhaps next term what I will do is we'll do a series on all the 10 Sfirot, actually going through each one specifically, and it'll be a good time to explain the Keter-Daat relationship. But often this is the way it's expressed, just Chochma Bina and so on. And then we talk about, so that's God's Sfirot, that's God's powers, and then what happens is that God... We said last week that he blew into us the soul of life. The blowing means coming from his essence. In other words, everything in the world connects back to the 10th Sfirot, but the soul of the human being, our soul, is not just connects back. Our soul is almost like an infusion of the divine energy coming, a manifestation of the 10th Sfirot. And therefore, the 10 powers that we have in our soul is really a evolution. It's really an outcome. It evolved, so to speak, from God's 10 Sfirot. Now, we touched on this last week, and I want to develop it a bit, but we touched on this last week that a healthy human being, because we say that the human body, the physical body also, is the home of the 10 powers. The head, the three parts of the brain, house the three components of intellect, Chochma Bina Daat. The heart is the epicenter of the emotions, and then that spreads to the rest of the body. And the healthy human being is one where the head rules the heart, which means the head guides the heart, where we have control over our emotions and they don't become explosive and impulsive and instinctive and all over the place, but we're able to guide them in a healthy way by that concept of the pause, which we talked about last week, that between response and stimulus, there's a pause where we think and we're able to make choices. The choices that we make rest in the brain, the choice that we make are in our head, are in our thinking, and that gives us the ability to choose right over wrong, good over evil, and so on and so forth. So I want to just stop there for a minute and just share with you two ideas which relates back, and then we're going to get into the whole concept of emotions and what that means. The word, I mentioned this very briefly last week. I want to just develop it a little bit and share with you a thought I once heard from a Hasidic rabbi, one actually that visits here once in a while, and he explained this once to me. You know, the word for king, word for ruler, leader in Hebrew is melech, right? You've got it on your handout there, with the melech, mem, lamed, chaf. Those, again, going back to the Hebrew language, which always, the letters and the words always have tremendous meaning. And those three letters, mem, lamed, and chaf, actually stand for three things. Moach, the brain, lev, the heart, and kaved, the liver, actually, right? And the reason for that is because a healthy human being and a human being who's in control of him or herself, in other words, not just being a melech, being a king over others, but being a king over ourselves, able to have mastery over our own healthy way of living, is a person who's a melech. A melech means that first and foremost is the moach, first is the brain, representing the intellect, that inspires and leads the lev, the heart, which then inspires and leads and causes healthy behavior, which Kabbalistically is represented by the liver, which is a whole different discussion, but that's what it is, right? So it's moach, lev, and kaved. Now, I'm just going to share with you a very interesting thing. There's a Chumash story. There's a Chumash story where we have the non-Jewish prophet Bilam, who was hired to curse the Jewish nation. I don't know if you're familiar with the story in Chumash. So there was the king called Balak, there was an anti-Semite, he was threatened by the Jewish nation coming out of Egypt, wandering in the desert, and the story goes he hires this non-Jewish prophet, Bilam, who was supposed to have powers in his speech, in his communication, and he was going to come and curse the Jewish people. And the story goes that God didn't let him curse the Jewish people, and in fact all these curses were transformed into blessings. In fact, some of our prayers come from what he said, the blessings that he gave when he saw the Jewish nation. Now, there's a very fascinating part of the Talmud that says that God provided for us a tremendous kindness during the time that Bilam was in the desert wanting to curse the Jewish nation. Why? Because the Talmud says an interesting thing. It says that there's different moments of the day where there's different energies and different powers. So there's one moment in the day, apparently, which no one knows when it is, but you have to be able to figure out when it is. There's one moment in the day that's a moment, a fleeting moment, where God's anger is kind of in force. That he's very particular, the justice, the power of justice is fully in force, and that's a very vulnerable moment, right? And the Talmud says that Bilam was such an intelligent and such a spiritual person with such great insight. He wasn't a good person, but he was an incredibly deep person with knowledge of esoterics and so on, that he would have been able to figure out that moment where the Jewish people are incredibly vulnerable. And had he been able to do that, he would have used that moment to curse the Jewish people, and it would have caused our destruction. I don't know. Couldn't tell you. I don't know what the moment is. Right? So the Talmud says a fascinating thing, that during the stay, that when Bilam was there, God removed that moment. That moment wasn't there. So therefore, even though he would have been able to figure it out, but that prevented him from doing any harm to the Jewish nation. So there's a very, very famous commentary in the Talmud called Tosfot. Tosfot is actually a group of rabbis. They were grandchildren of Rashi, actually. They lived in France in like the 13th century, 14th century, something like that. And they ask questions and interpret the Talmud. So Tosfot raises the following question. If we talk about this one fleeting moment, that Bilam, had it prevailed during that time, Bilam would have been able to curse the Jewish nation. What, just out of interest, says Tosfot, what would he have said in that moment? It's only a moment. I mean, to curse someone takes time. What was he going to say in that moment, right? So there's a number of answers. One of the answers that Tosfot provides, you'll see where I'm getting in a moment. Tosfot says the word he would have said, because it's a very quick moment, he would have said the word kalem. Kalem is destroy them. destroy them. He would have asked God to destroy them. Right. So that's the simple reading of this passage. So this big Hasidic rabbi told me, he says, no, let me explain to you what this means. He says, take the word kalem and you'll see it's the opposite of the word melech. Right? It's not just destroy them. Kalem is chaf lamed mem, which if we take the acronym that we just said, you see there on your handout, you said number four. Melech stands for moach, lev, kaved, brain, heart, and liver, in that order. Kalem is the opposite. It's kaved, lev, moach. Right? A destructive person is a person who behaves first, impulsively, then gets excited about it, and then has to rationalize it. And that's an unhealthy human being. And that's the depth of the meaning, that if Bilam was able to seize a moment and to curse the Jewish people, he would have said kalem. Because what he would have meant was, make them into people who are instinctive, impulsive people, reactive people, who don't think, who work the other way around, who work back to front, who work from behavior to the heart to the brain. People who work like that self-destruct at the end of the day. You don't need anyone to destroy them. They self-destruct themselves, right? Because to live a healthy lifestyle, to live like a normal valued life or the moral sort of lifestyle needs the other way around, needs to be a melech. So melech and kalem are those two opposites. Okay. That's the one idea I wanted to just share with you in terms of the relationship between the intellect and the emotion. The other thought I wanted to share with you on that is that we know that many years ago stood a temple in Jerusalem on Temple Mount. And that temple was sort of built on the same guidelines that God gave Moses in the desert when they built a tabernacle in the desert and they built the Mishkan. And the Kabbalists tell us the following, that this is sort of a bird's eye view of the Mishkan, of the basic outline of the temple. And essentially the temple had three parts, right? You should have a thing here. That top part over here, this part is called the Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. That was the holiest spot in the temple. And in that spot stood the tablets, the Luchot, the Ark, the Holy Ark. That was the holiest spot. In fact, that was a spot where no one went. Only the high priest used to go there once a year on Yom Kippur and so on. The next part was also in a building, but it was called the Heichal. This part, the Kodesh, that's where the three holy vessels stood, which was the candelabra, the menorah, the small golden altar, and the shulchan, the table, upon which they used to put the showbread. All that was like in a building, and then the rest of it was a courtyard, an open courtyard. And an open courtyard is where the most of the activity of the temple used to take place, actually, which was the Mizbeach, the big altar upon which they were being sacrificed and do the temple service. The Levites would sing there and they would pour wine on all the activity, the sacrificial and priestly rituals of the temple took place in the courtyard. Yep.
What's called showbread?
Gold showbread. Gold showbread. No, not the showbread wasn't gold. The table was gold. It's called gold showbread display table. Yeah, I just got that model off the internet. I actually wasn't paying attention to the words. I just wanted to show you the outline here. The vessels were made out of gold. It was an interesting shape. It was actually matzah, soft matzah. That they would put 12 of these breads in on Friday, the Kohanim, and would miraculously stay fresh the entire week. And the next Shabbat they'd be removed and the Kohanim would eat them and they'd replace them with another 12 showbreads. Incidentally, this is not on the topic at all, but there are some Kabbalists, you know, we have two chalot on Friday night table. Some Kabbalists have 12 because of those 12 showbreads. Now, although they have 12, we only have two, but actually very, very often the custom for our two is also to represent the 12. You know why challahs are plaited, right? They're braided, right? The real way to make braided challah is not the way you buy in the bakery, is six braided, which you have to know how to make. But like, why six braided? Six and six is 12. So we do on Shabbat, there's a custom to remember the 12 showbreads that were in the temple. That's why it's six. Each one is six braided because of 12. Yeah. Each food on Shabbat has tremendous. It's amazing. I mean, that's for another time. Okay, so the Kabbalists explain that this three sections of the temple represent the three parts of the human being. The Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies, is where the Torah was, the Luchot, the Ten Commandments, and a Torah scroll. intellect, in other words, learning, represents the values, the holiness, the essence of the human being, which is both the holiness, as we said last week, the subconscious, and the ability to think and to develop values and decision-making processes within our brain. That's the moach, that's the brain. The next part of the temple, which is also within the human being, are the three golden special vessels, which represent the three primary emotions. The three, upstairs, yeah. The three primary emotions, the three primary feelings of the human being, which, if you look at your triangle of the 10 powers, they go in triangles. If you look at the 10 sefirot, you'll see the emotions going two triangles. And when we go through them in greater detail another time, you'll see that the primary emotions of the person are the first three emotions, called chesed, gvura, and tiferet. So essentially that second part represent the emotions of the human being, right? And then the courtyard, so the brain and the heart are within the person. It's how we process things within ourselves in different ways, but it's all within ourselves. What that does is it results in the way we behave. The way we behave, of course, is outside of us, the way we implement our thinking and our feelings. And that's the courtyard of the temple, represents the action, the behavior of the human being. So again, it's the melech, it's the three components of the person, the head, the heart, and the liver, which is the thinking, the feeling, and then how we inspire our behavior. So the real trick is to get the thinking right and the feeling right. If we have the thinking right and the feeling right, we have our brain right, our intellect right, and our emotions right, the healthy behavior will just follow. It's when we don't react properly, we have the wrong unhealthy emotions or distorted thinking that's bringing unhealthy emotions, or we don't think altogether and we have impulsive emotions, that's where our behavior becomes destructive and ineffective. But if we get the moach and the lev, if we get the brain and the heart on track, the behavior follows. Okay. So last week we talked about the ability to think, the concept of thinking. We talked about the three components of thinking. We talked about being in control of our brain, and that's why we connected it to the concept of mindfulness, and being in control of how we think, and being conscious, and the ability to actually stop and focus and be conscious of how we're thinking. So tonight I want to talk about the emotional part of who we are, right? And also link that to even on a deeper level, to the concept of being mindful, which becomes even more critical when we talk about the way we feel. So the first question we need to ask ourselves is that when the Kabbalists tell us about the 10 powers of the soul, right? And they talk about intellect and emotion. What is emotions? What is the definition of an emotion? Anyone got any suggestions?
Something that you do before you think. Quick decision.
Before you think. Although we're saying that really should happen the other way around. We should really think and then modify our emotions. Okay, so emotion is actually a hard thing to define, what it actually is. Some will say it's feelings. Okay, it's similar. But what I want to share with you is a definition that helps us understand the critical function and the difference between how we think and how we feel. In other words, the head and the heart, if we can use it that way. The way it works is like this. This is the definition. The mind is where existence enters us, meaning... See, the brain is the doorway, okay, through which the universe, the people, the experiences, physical, spiritual, everything that's outside of us can be absorbed into us by understanding it, by internalizing it, by processing it, by interpreting it, and so on and so forth, right? In other words, the mind is the doorway, the window, through which the world outside of us enters us. Yeah, we okay with that? The heart is the other way around. The heart is the door through which we connect to the outside. That's the difference. In other words, we respond to what we're absorbing. Right? It's the way we express ourselves to the outside world. Now, we don't do it until we behave. In other words, it's our response to the outside. When we implement our emotions, that's how we behave. But it's the feeling of how we're responding to something outside of us. That's what we talk about, stimulus and response that happens in the heart. In other words, something happens, we absorb it, and we respond, right? That response is driven by emotion. It's driven by how we feel about it. Okay? This can be the physical world around us, the spiritual world around us, any experience, any person. It's the way we connect. So the mind is how we absorb what is happening outside of us. The heart is where we respond to what's happening outside of us. Okay? Now, this is critical. And that's why emotions play such an incredibly critical part and role in human existence. Because when God created Adam, as we've talked before, we know an interesting thing happened. When he created Adam, he created him alone. Right? And the Talmud tells us, the rabbis tell us that the Adam, the human being, was created different to every other animal. All other animals were created in pairs. The human being was created in singularly, individually. Why? Yechidi, as the Hebrew word goes. Now that in itself needs explanation, but the basic explanation is that the person was created alone to teach us that every individual, every human being, is what our rabbis refer to as olam malei, an entire cosmos, an entire world. The value of each human being, the value of each individual, on the one hand. On the other hand, right after he created Adam, the Torah tells us the following. It says, lo tov, it's not good for the man to be alone. And the word that's used in the Chumash, the word that's used in the Torah, for alone is the word levado. Right? Now, levado can have two translations. This is what the commentaries point out. Levado can mean alone, or levado can mean lonely. And there's a very big difference. Okay? What that means is as follows. The essence of the human being, and this is such an important thing to understand, the essence of the human being, well, let's go back a second. The power of the human being is our mind. The essence of the human being is our heart. What do I? Because the essence of the human being is relationships. Not only with people, it's relationships with the rest of the world. God created the world because he wanted to connect to the world, and he created us in his image because he wanted us to connect to everything else. He didn't want us to be alone, he didn't want us to be lonely, he wanted us to connect with the world around us. Okay? So the essence of the human being is connections to other things, other people, connections to experiences, connection to ideas, connection to things around us. The essence of the human being is to be connected, to go out of ourselves, to leave our little existence and connect to the world around us in a positive, valuable, moral, deep way. And the way to do that is to connect in a way where we're not lonely. Now, I use the word lonely because alone and lonely are very different. You can have 4 million Facebook friends and you can still be very lonely, right? Because having people around you doesn't mean you're connected to them. You can have one friend and not be lonely. In fact, the Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, tells us that every person should make for themselves a spiritual mentor. It's called Asei Lecha Rav. And it says, "Uknei lecha chaver," acquire for yourself a friend. And interesting, if you look at the grammar, it doesn't say acquire for yourself friends, which is a good thing. That's a social thing, to have a lot of friends. But real connection is, "Uknei lecha chaver," acquire for yourself a friend. Because it could be even an individual friend if it's a real friend, right? So the idea is that God gave us this ability, this tool, to first of all absorb the world around us, so we process the world around us. That's through the mind, where we can take in and we can observe, we can notice, or we can become conscious, we can absorb and interpret and process the world around us. But the purpose was then to turn that around and connect and respond to the people in the world around us in a healthy way. Okay. So that's why the Talmud tells us that the person's personality is not in his or her mind. The personality of the person is in the emotion, it's in the feeling, it's how we respond to other people. That's where you see what type of person it is. Yeah.
You know, the emotions are very private. It's like our thoughts are, mm-hmm. Our emotions are...
No, you can keep them private, but by definition...
For them to, the emotions to flow out, we allow them to flow into action.
Okay, so that's what I said before. Emotions are not how you actually connect, but the beginning of connection is through your emotion. In other words, like this. If I'm feeling a feeling of kindness, kindness means I want to be kind to other people. I might keep it private, which is ineffective, of course, but you can still keep emotions private, but then emotions, the definition of emotions is not how you are understanding something else, it's how you're feeling about something else. So it's about inside out rather than outside in. That's what I'm saying. Now, that's why the last one of the emotions is something we call malchut, which is implementation, leadership, which is how you actually process the emotions and make them work. But that's a separate story. But the definition of emotions is how we connect to the outside. In other words, you cannot skip that level. You cannot connect to the outside without emotions. That's why in relationships, emotions are so important. Love, respect, and so on, these things, because that's how we connect. That's where the essence of the human being is. That's where the personality of the person is. Right? Now, here's the important thing to understand. There's three scenarios. Because we talk about good emotions and bad emotions, but there's a third scenario, right? So what happens is as follows. A person can be, we said emotions is how you create relationships. Relationships with not only people, with everything around us, right? And we know in relationships you can have no relationship, you can have a bad relationship, or you can have a good relationship, right? And that's how it works with our emotions. The way it works is as follows. Lack of emotion, when a person is unable to express their emotions altogether, that's a state of loneliness. Now, this person has no feeling. They're wrapped up in themselves, they're cold, they're detached, right? You talk about a person who's has lacks feelings, right? Lacks emotions. You talk about a person who's removed, who's detached. That's a state of loneliness. They might not know that, but it is. Right? So lack of emotion is very different to unhealthy emotion. Right? Lack of emotion is a state of loneliness, of detachment. Healthy emotions creates healthy relationships. What's the definition of a healthy relationship? Where two things come together, and they come together well. They fit with each other, expressed by a calmness, by a tranquility, by two things harmonizing and synchronizing together. Right? In other words, there's lack of conflict. They're coming together well. Right? Unhealthy emotion is where you have conflict, tension, and disharmony. So unhealthy emotion is there is emotion, which means there is a connection, but it's a bad connection. So it's a conflict connection. It's a connection of tension, of conflict, right? Of a relationship that is there, but not working well. Now, this is where the concept of mindfulness and being mindful is so critical to the concept of emotions. And let's try to understand this. Emotional health. You see, it's much easier, not easy, but it's easier to be mindful of the mind. What do I mean? You see, when we're aware of the things we are processing and bringing in from the outside, if we pay attention and we learn to focus, which is not an easy thing today, and that's what mindfulness is all about, but when we become aware of the things outside of us, we become aware of the gifts that we have, we become aware of the clothes that we wear, the things that we taste, the breath that God has given us, the soul that He's given us, we become aware of God's world, the beauty of the world, and so on and so forth. That's a difficult thing. We have to learn to focus, but at least we know what we're being aware of. We know what we're being mindful of. To be really mindful of our own emotions, and I know I'm using the word mindful, which is the mind, but to be conscious, to be aware of how we're feeling, to be aware of our own emotions, which is critical for emotional health, that's much, much more difficult. Why? Because to be aware of how we're feeling means to be aware of the I. Remember, the personality of the person is in the emotion. And the I is a very complicated story. Because the I is subjective. The I is very subjective. The I has issues of conflict between the ego and the soul, as we spoke about last week, right? And it's very, very difficult to be really aware sometimes of what we're really feeling. And that's why often people have unhealthy emotions, and part of the reason is because the emotions are very misplaced. I recently had a story with someone who, I mean, it'll pass and I'll get over it and the time will heal. But they were very, very angry with me for something. Now, I know what it is and there's nothing I can do about it. And I'm not going to tell you the story, of course, but the process was I didn't do anything wrong and it was 100% okay and it was the moral thing to do. But there was no choice. But they were completely angry with me for something. But it turned out they were completely angry with the wrong thing. In fact, they didn't even know what they were angry with. As an outsider, I kind of have much more of an insight who they were angry with, really, right, and what they were angry with, It was completely misplaced, because often the subjectivity of the human being is so confusing that even when we think we know exactly what we're feeling, we actually don't. It's very misplaced, it's very confused, and it's very distorted. We sometimes feel that what we're feeling is virtuous, and really it's not. Like sometimes we feel angry with someone, and really what it is, it's a feeling of jealousy, but we're not aware of it. It's a feeling of anger. It's egocentricity, although we might not feel that. People rationalize themselves. Often people do things in the name of goodness and morality, and really it's just an extension of their own ego. It's a very difficult thing to really be aware and to be brutally honest with our own feelings and to be mindful of what we're really feeling. Right? But it's critical. It's a process which we actually have to learn to do. It's a process that we actually have to go through and try and build up that ability of really being aware of how we're feeling and what we're feeling. It can be not even with other people. It can be sometimes we're just feeling very down, feeling upset, and we're not sure what it is. We blame it on one thing, but really it's another thing. Or we might be anxious about something, and it's expressing itself in being sad rather than being anxious, and it's two different things. And just because the mind and the feelings play all sorts of tricks with us, and because it's more about the way we feel and the personality of the I is in the emotions, the I is so complicated, it's very, very difficult to be fully aware. So we know that in the 90s, the concept of emotional intelligence was developed and emerged as a very, very important thing, right? And emotional intelligence means, and it's an incredible thing, because you have people who are incredibly intelligent and not emotionally intelligent, because it's two separate things completely. Incredibly intelligent means the ability to be able to have the academic ability to process things on the outside. Some people have a greater ability than others, so therefore becomes a person can be amazingly intelligent with that. And yet you have people who are incredibly intelligent on that level and incredibly stupid, if you know what I mean. Like they're very, very silly people. Why? Because the emotional intelligence is lacking. It's not the academic intelligence. They could interpret someone else's problem, but they just can't interpret their own, because their own emotions are involved, and therefore they're unable to really process their own feelings. They're not exactly sure why they're responding and how they're responding, right? And therefore that whole concept of recognizing and understanding and the ability to manage our own emotions needs an incredible ability of being incredibly mindful and aware of our own emotions. So when they talk about emotional intelligence, for example, they break it down into different concepts. So for example, we talk about being aware of our reactions, being able to tell the difference between reacting in a healthy way, reacting in an unhealthy way, right? So emotions about reactions. We keep on reacting to stimulus around us. That's the emotional pathway from the heart out, to become aware of how we react and how our reactions are impacting on other people and so on and so forth. The ability to recognize negative emotions that we have. That's a very difficult thing to do, because people are, as the Talmud says, people are related to themselves. It's very hard. We have a certain bias, a certain subjectivity, which makes it very difficult to actually recognize unhealthy and negative emotions that we might be having. Emotional intelligence is also about understanding the ability to modify our emotions. In other words, becoming aware of our emotions and having the ability to change them. And understanding that there's a choice behind that change. We actually, at the end of the day, as difficult as it seems, we choose to hate or to love. We choose to be jealous or not to be jealous. We choose even to be happy or not happy. Right? Now that's a difficult choice sometimes, and it's impacted on by so many different factors. But at the end of the day, it's a choice. But that choice can only happen, number one, if we're aware we have that choice, and secondly, if we're aware of what we're feeling now, if we know how we're feeling, then we can know how to change it. If we're not even sure what we're feeling, it's very difficult to change. The idea of empathy, right? So this is an important thing. Because emotion is about relationships, so here's a critical thing. Relationships means where you connect to someone else's world. And that's hard. And that's what empathy means. In other words, emotion is not about just what I'm feeling. Because if the role of emotions is to create a connection to someone else or to something else, I've got to really understand and become aware of that someone else. So that's where empathy comes in. Compassion comes in. Understanding of someone else's perception comes in. You know, Stephen Covey said that in the Seven Habits, he was once asked about, everyone has a difficult habit. It's a great model, the Seven Habits of Effective People. So he was once asked, which habit does he find the most difficult? He was a guru in all seven habits. So he was asked, which habit does he find the most difficult? So he said that the most difficult one for him is habit number five, which is seek to understand and then be understood. Right? To really understand someone else's world is incredibly, incredibly difficult. Why? Because we are so strong and so passionate about the way we feel about something. In other words, we are so passionate about how we connect and how we're responding to something, that it's very difficult to see it a different way. It's very difficult to understand it a different way, and it's very difficult to understand how we can actually choose to change and to modify the way we respond. That's a very, very difficult thing, and that's where the whole concept, as I said, of empathy and compassion comes in. So that's where those are the various components of emotional intelligence. But what's behind all of these components, and the first step to all of these components, is the concept of being aware of what we're feeling, becoming mindful not only of the things we understand, but becoming mindful of how we actually feel. And that's very, very difficult. That's one concept of mindfulness when it comes to the way we feel. You know, you could try this with yourself. You can challenge yourself a little bit. Like, sometimes when you're feeling upset with someone, or you're feeling angry with someone, or you're feeling uneasy with something or a situation, you can challenge yourself. Part of the reason that we don't challenge ourselves is because we're afraid. Like, we're afraid to have to change. We don't want to change. Because changes people find difficult. But that's the concept, to practice that challenging ourselves. Maybe what I'm feeling is not so good. Maybe it's unhealthy. Let's become aware of really how I'm feeling and challenge ourselves without fear. And even if we have to change, change is ultimately a liberating thing, not a threatening thing. So that's one idea. The other idea, in terms of the relationship between being mindful and our emotions, and this is where managing our emotions is so important, is another concept they talk about in mindfulness literature, which is incredibly difficult but incredibly critical. And it's very in line with a very, very Jewish idea. They call it the freshness of the moment, or the beginner's mind. Right? The idea being that in order to understand, in order to live in each moment to the fullest, in order to really get the full potential out of each moment, there's something they call the beginner's mind. What is that? In other words, the basic idea behind it, and we don't have time for it now, but I will tell you that the Jewish perspective on it and the typical mindfulness perspective have fundamental differences, but the basic idea is the same. And the basic idea is that we need to be able to see each moment as a completely fresh moment, right? Very often, and particularly in the world of emotion, much more than the world of intellect, every moment is intertwined and affected by and impacted by another moment. What do I mean? So when you're thinking through a concept, take an academic idea, an intellectual idea, right? You can process one idea, you can finish it, you can understand it, you can then close the book and understand a completely different idea. Or even better, if you were thinking of something that's got nothing to do with you, but it's a purely academic exercise. I know we did this a lot in yeshiva when we were an in-depth Talmud, right? We'd learn a dispute between, let's say, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel, or between two great rabbis of the Talmud. And they each come with completely different perspectives, and the role of the Talmud student is to understand each one's perspective. So you have a shiur, or you go and learn a great commentary, and you go in-depth, that I'm going to put myself now in the head of Rabbi Yehuda, and I want to understand what he's saying, right? So I'll do that for an hour or 2 hours, and I'll come up with a whole understanding and fully understand his point of view. Okay, so I've done it. Now I've mastered, or I think I've mastered, his point of view. But now I've got to master the other point of view, Rabbi Meir's point of view, let's say. Right? I'm just mentioning those two because they often argue in the Talmud. Right? So okay, so then it's actually quite easy, because it's nothing to do with me, and it doesn't affect me on an emotional level. It's actually quite easy, okay, to say, okay, that's Rabbi Yehuda, I'll put that in a box. Now I'm going to go Rabbi Meir's way. Let's redo this whole thing. Let's look at this completely differently. Let's take my mind and look at it from a completely different perspective, and I'm going to think through it, and I'm going to come out understanding Reb Meir's way. The end result will be I'll understand both perspectives, and that's how you learn Talmud, right? I'm just giving an example of. But when it's purely academic, the power of the mind is to be able to divide that. to compartmentalize that. That's the power of the mind. That's why we can make decisions. That's why the mind is the tool to change the way you want to behave, because we're able to look at things differently. We're able to interpret things and come up with a fresh perspective and make a decision based on a new perspective, let's say. Because the mind is able to do that because it's very detached. It's very removed from the whole. It's not emotionally involved, and therefore it's okay to divide up the moments, to divide up the perspectives. I've understood this perspective, now I'm going to completely change around and look at a different perspective. The problem is when the emotions are involved, that's much more difficult. Why? Because generally speaking, often we're unable to fully live and to fully make the maximize the potential of every given moment, because we're still carrying the emotional baggage of the previous moment, or the previous day, or the previous week, or the previous month, or the previous year, right? How often do we have an emotional lapse or weakness or a struggle where we're upset about something or upset with someone, and we carry it with us for weeks on end? As Rabbi Tversky always says, we let the other person live in our mind rent-free, right? Which doesn't help. The person's forgotten about it, certainly doesn't help us. And what happens is, well, we do it anyways. Why? Because it's hard, because it's emotional. It's about us. It's about me. It's about the I, right? All the worries of the future. Now, worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow doesn't help now. We know that. And yet we still do that. Now, of course, worry has its place, and it plays a role. So does the baggage of the past play a role, because we can learn from the past and we can be responsible about the future. We can make decisions and plan. If we understand, you know, if someone's not well, then we understand there's a certain urgency, so we have to worry to a certain level to make the right choices in terms of planning a good course of action. Fine. But what we don't do is, things that are out of our control, we still carry it with us. And therefore we carry the baggage of the past, the worries of the future, that we can't control, that have nothing to do with the present moment, and yet it's all mixed into the present moment, and therefore we're unable to live the present moment because of what we're worried about yesterday. We're carrying the baggage of yesterday and worrying about tomorrow, right? That's just the human way. Now, part of mindfulness is to be able to separate that and understand, no, just look at every moment as a completely fresh moment. Now, I'm going to just say this briefly because time's running out, but from a Jewish perspective, this is an incredibly Jewish idea. We have this idea, in fact, we say it every single day in our prayers, that God renews the creation every single day. God creates a new world. We have this concept in Kabbalah where it interprets a sentence that God didn't create the world so many thousands of years ago and let it run, but actually the divine creative force. We are taught in the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov particularly, that the creative, divine creative force, that's the force that created the heaven and the earth, is a continuous creative force. And it recreates the world every single moment. In other words, every single day, every single moment, it's a fresh world. It's a fresh opportunity. It's a fresh existence with the infusion of God's infinite divine energy giving us infinite potential. Which is the whole idea we talked about previously about the Modeh Ani prayer. We wake up in the morning. What's the idea? We wake up in the morning and we say to God, Modeh Ani Lefanecha, I acknowledge you and I thank you for giving back my soul, to give me a fresh soul and a fresh day. Now, who knows what happened yesterday? And who knows what took place yesterday that could interfere with my living today? But the first thing we try and say in the morning is, apart from the gratitude aspect of it, that I thank God for giving me another day, actually it's about the word Modeh. It doesn't only mean thank you, it also means to acknowledge, to process, to really be mindful of the fact that today's a new day, to separate today's emotions from yesterday's emotions, be able to shift into the moment and to say, what's today's role? What's today's mission? What's today's potential? Now, I need to learn from yesterday. I need to plan for tomorrow. That's true. But nevertheless, I don't need to let the emotions and the feelings of yesterday interfere with today. Right? That's what they call the beginner's mind and the freshness of the moment. And that's much easier to do intellectually. It's much harder to do emotionally. I'm just going to tell you a little story that brings out this concept. It's a funny story, but it's a story that brings it out very well. It's a story about two great, very, very famous Hasidic Rebbes. They were brothers, called Reb Zusha and Reb Elimelech. Reb Zusha of Anipoli and Reb Elimelech. It's very famous. There's lots of stories with them, of the two of them together. They would travel around together and so on. One time, the story goes like this, that they were traveling around Europe, Poland, and those areas where there were some very hostile regimes and hostile governments and so on and so forth. One of the things they used to do often is they would try and ransom, they would try and redeem Jews who had been thrown into jail for not paying the rent on time, you know, in the feudal system and so on and so forth. In other words, one time they had a clash with the authorities, they were arrested and they were thrown into a prison cell. And this prison cell was a rough prison cell, it was a big prison cell with lots of prisoners there, all kinds of really rough and low class people. And these two great rebbes suddenly find themselves in a prison cell. In the prison cell, there was this, I'm going to try and say it as refined as I possibly can, but there was a bucket, right? It wasn't a very sophisticated prison cell. And there was a bucket that was placed there in order for people to do what they need to do to relieve themselves and so on. So suddenly Rabbi Elimelech becomes very, very upset. So Rabbi Zusha turns to him and he says, "Why are you upset?" He says, you don't see what's going on here? There's this thing here that means halachically we can't pray. That's the law. It's like you can't pray in a bathroom, right? You can't. So we're going to be stuck here and we're going to be unable to perform the mitzvah of davening. So Rabbi Zusha says to him, "I don't understand you." He says, "Why do you want to pray?" Listen to this amazing concept, right? He says, "Why do you want to pray? You want to pray because God told you to pray, right? So the same God who told you to pray told you that now you can't pray. So right now, for this moment, not praying is a mitzvah. Normally every day when you get up in the morning, praying, davening is a big mitzvah. Today, for us, not praying is a great mitzvah. Because the same God who told us to pray said today we shouldn't pray. Because we can't pray because this thing is here." So Rabbi Elimelech thinks about it. He says, "You know, you're 100% right. Wow, what an amazing opportunity. Let's seize the moment." Now, these Hasidic rebbes used to place tremendous emphasis on serving God with joy. That's why, you know, the Hasidim, when they came around, they introduced a lot of dancing, a lot of singing. This was a Hasidic thing. The Baal Shem Tov introduced this, right? Suddenly, Rabbi Elimelech and Rabbi Zusha look at each other and they say, "What a moment. We have this opportunity to serve God today in a way which we normally can't serve Him." And they started to dance. And they were singing and dancing. Why? Because they couldn't pray. Because God said they couldn't pray and they're performing this mitzvah. Story goes, suddenly, these Cossacks, right, where all these guys sitting around them, they see these two guys dancing. They have no idea, but it looks like a good party. So eventually, the tune catches on. And everyone starts to join in. And there's this whole dancing going on. And suddenly these rough prison guards standing outside come in and they're really gruffy and they're very upset and say, what's the party? So the guys answer, "We actually don't know, but these two guys have just arrived here, these newcomers are dancing. It's got something to do with this bucket, but we don't know, but we're not quite sure what, but we're having a good time." So they got really, really angry and said, "Having a good time? The bucket? Okay, we'll take away the bucket. And when you need it, you'll let us know." Take it away. Suddenly everyone stops dancing. Rabbi Elimelech looks at his brother Rabbi Zusha and says, "Hey, we can pray. We can pray." So they start dancing again, right? So it's a funny story, but the story brings out an amazing idea. Amazing idea is that this concept of treating each moment separately, having the ability to let go and to ask ourselves the question, forget about what happened till now. And that's very easy to say and hard to do. But the step one is at least getting the concept right and becoming aware of this idea that actually each moment, each breath we take is separate. Each breath we take, as we said last week, the breath is a symbol of the neshama, of the soul, right? Because neshima and neshama is the same word. Breath and soul, same word. Each breath we take, it's a rhythm. Each breath we take is separate, distinct from the other one. We let go of the past, we let go of the worries of the future, and we ask ourselves the question, what is the potential of this moment, right? Now that is an incredibly difficult thing to become aware of, conscious of, and focus on. Because when it has to do with our emotional health, it's very difficult to let go. And that letting go on an emotional level is incredibly important and incredibly powerful. That idea to be able to say, yes, I had this problem yesterday, I was upset yesterday, I had a run-in with yesterday, I failed yesterday, I was hurtful to someone yesterday, I messed up yesterday, someone messed up with me yesterday, whatever the case is. But the ability to wake up and say, that was yesterday and I'm going to learn from it. Maybe there's times in the future I'm going to designate time to think about it and to see what I can learn from it and so on and so forth. But right now, it's a new day. It's a new moment. It's a new mission. It's a new role. It's a new potential. And that's where that second part of mindfulness comes so into the concept of emotion. So therefore, when we talk about emotional health, just to summarize, the intellect is how we take the world outside into ourselves. Emotions are how we take us and connect and build a relationship with the world around us. That's only possible to do in a healthy way, because lack of emotion is loneliness. Bad emotion is a bad connection. Healthy emotion is responding in the right way. Step one is becoming, learning to become aware of how we feel and how we are feeling at the present moment and how we actually are really feeling in terms of our response to the stimulus that is happening outside of us. And the second thing is to develop that ability of treating each moment freshly, each moment separately, each moment with a fresh mission, a fresh role, a fresh moment. As I said, we're gonna, that's just, these two things are highlights. We're gonna do an exercise soon and try feel this a little bit. But I just wanted to mention before we do that, that probably at the beginning of next year, just pay attention to the emails and so on. We'll probably do a longer course where we're actually gonna go through each of the 10 powers, because it's actually quite a powerful thing, understanding the role of each one of the three intellectual components, the six primary emotions, and the last one, the malchut, and that becomes quite a powerful formula in terms of how we develop.